This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will return next week. Coming up, the state of New Jersey is on trial for its treatment of a prisoner in solitary confinement. A new book is highly critical of Huey Newton's leadership of the Black Panther Party. And Mumia Abu-Jamal on the Israeli settler regime's war against Palestine. But first, when the U.S. Justice Department found police in Newark, New Jersey, had long engaged in a pattern of unconstitutional treatment of blacks, the People's Organization for Progress was in a unique position to say, "We told you so." The grassroots organization has been fighting police brutality and corruption in Newark for 35 years. POP Chairman Larry Hamm also supports a proposed law called the New Jersey Decarceration Act, which would dramatically reduce the state's prison population.
The way the criminal justice system is working, not only in New Jersey, but in the country, is that what we are doing is creating not just a class system, but we're creating a caste system in New Jersey. We're creating a permanent class out of which people cannot escape. You know, it's almost like, you know, people, when people think of the caste system, they think of India, you know, and they think of the untouchables. But we're creating a kind of class of untouchables in the United States by continuing to punish people who were incarcerated even after they have served their time, completed their jail sentence. And if a man can't get a job, if a man can't find a place to live, if a man can't get food to eat, it's inevitable that that person will resort to illegal means to hold life and limb together. So, yes, we support the New Jersey Decarceration Act and reduce the prison population in the state. But in addition to that, we also call for reforms that will help formerly incarcerated people to find jobs, to find housing, to get back on their feet so that they can become productive members of society and won't be caught in the prison revolving door where people come out and within 6 months they're back in.
And of course, insane levels of incarceration are related to facts such as those uncovered by the federal investigation that 75% of the people accosted by police in Newark, New Jersey, their constitutional rights have been violated.
Yes, and this is an amazing statistic. I know folks in Jersey, because we're in the New York media market, most of the time we get more news about what's going on in New York than we do about what's going on in New Jersey. So a lot of people in Newark, every day we're hearing about stop and frisk in New York and how unconstitutional that was and so on and so forth, not realizing that right here in Newark, we had a higher rate of unconstitutional stops of citizens by police than they have in New York. And that the good thing about what has happened recently is that the U.S. Justice Department, so nobody can just offhandedly dismiss this, well, it's those radicals from the People's Organization for Progress, or it's the left-wing liberal ACLU. They can't offhandedly dismiss the claims now because the U.S. Justice Department of the United States government has come out now and said that the police are behaving in a manner that's violating the constitutional rights of Newark residents in an overwhelming type of way. And it's not just this violation of constitutional rights. When the Justice Department tells you that the people who are supposed to protect and serve are out there arresting drug dealers, taking their money and taking their drugs and then turning around and selling them back illegally, it's mind-boggling. We have a member of our organization who had a warrant out. It was unpaid parking ticket or something like that. And he was driving and he was stopped by the police and was arrested. He's very, very sick. and so he has to take certain kinds of medicine. The police took his medicine, and when he went back to the desk where you get your belongings after you're released after an arrest, his medicine was not there. And he made a complaint to Internal Affairs, and of course, nothing came of it. That was the other finding of the Justice Department report, was that scores of complaints are filed by Newark citizens every year. And I think they said out of like 82 complaints that have been filed, only one had been taken seriously by the Internal Affairs Division of the Newark Police Department. So it's a real serious problem. And I would dare say that this is not a Newark problem. It's not a New York problem. This is a national problem. And, you know, we can't overlook the fact that although the police have abused the rights of citizens of all races, the fact of the matter is that 95% or more of police brutality cases, police misconduct cases, use of excessive force, abuse of citizens' constitutional rights, 95% or more of those cases are against African Americans. And that this is not just a policing issue, this is a civil rights and human rights issue, that African Americans are treated in a significantly different manner than are other citizens of the United States. Newark becomes the first city in New Jersey whose police force is being placed under a federal monitor. It becomes the 13th city in the United States that's being placed under federal monitor. But a federal monitor came into New Jersey before, and I'm sure you remember when the federal monitor was placed over the New Jersey State Troopers. Everyone was speaking out about how they were being stopped by state troopers. But we said back then, and this was certainly a dozen and 15 years ago, we said then that the federal monitors should not only be looking at the state troopers, they should be looking at local municipal police forces, because there were probably more violations of citizens' rights by local police forces than there were by state troopers. And I think that this Justice Department study gives support to what we had said at that time. Let me say one more thing. This is a problem that President Obama must address. This is a problem that Eric Holder must address. Now, I'll say Eric Holder has made some statements about the use of excessive force and police misconduct, but President Obama, beyond the beer summit that he held between the Professor Gates and the officer that abused Professor Gates, President Obama has to address this problem in a serious way before he leaves office. I mean, at least make a statement about it, beyond sympathetic statements toward the victim, like, you know, my son could be Trayvon. If I had a son, he might end up like Trayvon Martin. We need a serious statement. We need a serious address from President Obama, from Eric Holder, on the problem of police misconduct, excessive use of force, violation of citizens' constitutional rights. We need them to address this problem in a serious way before he leaves office. He's only got about, I think, 24 months left, right? And if he doesn't, then that will be a serious, serious disappointment to the African-American community, particularly when 95% of these cases are abuse of the rights of black people in this country, people of African descent. Because what's happening in Newark is happening in every major city and probably elsewhere. You know, and it's not just a national problem, it's an international problem. When you go to the Caribbean, you hear folks talking about police brutality. When you go to big cities in Africa, you hear people talk about police brutality. When you go to Europe, you hear people talking about police brutality. This is really an international problem. But suffice it to say, for the United States of America, that the first African-American president elected must address this problem. And if he does not, it will be a significant disappointment to our community. What we have to understand with regard to how police interact with African-Americans is the historical role of the use of force against black people in this country. Why is it that 95% or more of these cases of police brutality, use of excessive force, police murder, violation of people's constitutional rights, why is it that 95% or more of these cases are against African Americans? I also add in people of color. And to understand this, I think you must understand the historical role of the use of force. First of all, you cannot enslave millions of black people without the use of force. The system of slavery was essentially a system of violent, unabated, uncontrolled, unrestrained use of force, deadly force, against the African population, and that this use of force was encoded in law, in not only in national law, but in international law at the time of the slave trade, and that both government and civil society, whites had the right to use excessive force, to use force, period, against black people. Modern state militia, as we know it today, developed out of the slave patrols that were assembled in those colonies where there were large numbers of African slaves. Herbert Aptheker, the historian, I actually saw him say in an interview that modern police forces, as we know them today in big cities, developed in response to the migration of African Americans from the rural areas to the urban areas and from the south to the north, that as we came into the cities and as we moved north, white-dominated municipal governments began to create police forces and bolster the police forces that they had in order to either keep the African populations moving through their cities or, in fact, to put them into areas that were identified for them and to keep them in those areas. So we have to understand that police brutality is not just an aberration. It's not just the activity of a few, quote unquote, bad apples in the police forces. Police brutality is not only caused by racism on the part of individual officers. It is also part of an institutional effort to contain and control African Americans in this country. It is part of a system of racial control. And until people really begin to grasp this, then the types of reforms that we put in place are going to be inadequate. I've heard several press conferences since the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, and POP went with other New Jersey organizations. We went over to Staten Island. We had a little rally over there at the spot where Eric Garner was killed. And I've heard again and again Bratton say, well, we're going to have training. We're going to have training. They have been doing sensitivity training, urban training, all kind of training for the past 40 years. Training by itself is not going to eliminate this problem. They're going to have to be more drastic reforms put in place, because the problem is just going to continue, because it's not just a problem that stems from individual behavior. It is an institutional issue. It is an institutional response to black people. And it has not only to do with slavery, but it has very much to do with the civil rights movement and the uprising that took place in this country in the 1960s. Most people do not know that between 1960 and 1972, there were more than 1,000 urban uprisings in the United States. And the People's Organization for Progress, we celebrate and have celebrated almost from the beginning of the founding of our organization. We celebrated the Newark Rebellion of 1967. But every city in New Jersey had a rebellion. In fact, the Newark Rebellion wasn't even the first rebellion. The rebellions in Paterson and Jersey City took place before the Newark Rebellion. And rebellions took place in other cities before the rebellions in New Jersey. And the rebellions continued. They didn't stop in the 60s. The last major rebellion in New Jersey was in Camden, and that was in 1971. And other rebellions have taken place in other cities across this country since the 60s. But what I'm saying is the 60s was such a period of turbulence. As a matter of fact, people in power, such as J. Edgar Hoover and others, the FBI and the CIA, they thought there was going to be a revolution. So what we have seen since the 1960s has been the increased militarization of police forces all across this country. In fact, they have these SWAT teams now, and we actually see the police use vehicles and equipment no different from the vehicles and equipment that soldiers used in the U.S. imperialist wars abroad that have been used in Vietnam and in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, and in Grenada, and other places. So black people have to understand that we are viewed as an insurgent force in America, whether you engage in rebellion or whether you don't engage in a rebellion. Our black skins have placed us in a position of being viewed as an insurgent and a population that is in need of control. And whatever has to be done to control us, to keep us in our place, to keep us from resisting against racism and oppression and exploitation, whatever has to be done to hold us down, to hold us back, is going to be done. And police brutality is just one symptom of that whole system of racial control. It is a system, and we have to look at it as a system of racial control in this country. And I don't care if you work in a corporation, you work for the government, you work for the church, I don't care who you work for. Everyone knows that of all the different populations in this country, that African Americans historically have resisted the powers that be, have historically been one of the major forces for social change in this country, going all the way back to slavery, up through Jim Crow, into the Black Power Movement, and into today. And they know that although there have not been any major uprisings in most of the cities as there were during the 60s, there have been some. There have been, you know, like we had L.A., Rodney King, and there was an uprising in Liberty City in Florida, in Miami. He had a major uprising in Cincinnati, and so on and so forth. Even though there has not been a nationwide response like we had during the 60s, they know that the potential is always there. The potential is always there. And they have put all kinds of pieces in place to get ready for the day of reckoning, because they know people can only take so much. And they know that African Americans will resist. I think what they're worried about now is that there's the potential for us to build alliances with other groups in the population who have been economically disenfranchised in the last few decades, and that there could be an even wider societal-wide response to the suffering that's going on in this country. Even Dr. King, you know, most people, first of all, they don't know the whole story about Dr. King. They only know the I Have a Dream speech. And, you know, many people, particularly folks who consider themselves as radical or militant or whatever, they deride the I Have a Dream speech. But even in the I Have a Dream speech, Dr. King is talking about police brutality. He actually says police brutality. in the I Have a Dream speech. If you look at some of the pictures from the March on Washington in 63, people were carrying signs about police brutality. You go all the way back to the 19th century, and blacks were talking about how they were treated by the local police, the local constables, the local sheriff. I just wanted to place the problem in some type of historical and political context. Because if we just understand it as the aberrant behavior of some individuals, then we really miss the big picture.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark. Also in New Jersey, an extraordinary trial is underway in a complaint brought by Lester Alford, who charges he was not only unfairly placed in solitary confinement for 3 years, but was also treated more harshly than other inmates in isolation. We spoke with Gene Ross, who's an organizer for the People's Organization for Progress and has been a legal advisor to many incarcerated people. She says prison authorities tried to break Lester Alford's spirit.
They only gave him one set of clothing for 3 years. They did not let him clean his cell for 3 years. They did not give him the implements so that he could clean his cell or clean the shower that was part of his cell for 3 years, which they do for all other prisoners, so that bacteria and mold and dirt accumulated. In addition, when other prisoners basically in the same unit of the prison would flush their toilets, the effluvia would come up into his toilet and would overflow and be on his floor. He had no way of cleaning that up. So he was under conditions that were dangerous to his health and also conditions that should not pertain in a prison in a presumably democratic and civilized society. So it's very strange that all of the other ways that the Department of Corrections has to place people in solitary confinement, they have to have hearings. They have to give people notice of why they're placing them in solitary confinement. They have to afford them not all of the protections of a criminal trial, but some procedural protections. They can even have paralegals assist them. And once a decision is made to place a person in solitary confinement in these other ways that are defined by regulation, in punitive administrative segregation, or even in the management control unit, which is a unit basically of preventative detention, even in that unit they have these procedural protections of notice and some form of hearing, and then also some form of review. Lester Alford was given none of those protections. He was taken from his cell and placed under these extreme conditions with no opportunity to see or to challenge why this was happening or for this matter to be reviewed. And when the prison affords people these hearings, which apply to everyone else but Lester, basically, you have the opportunity to appeal not only within the prison system, but then to go outside the prison system to the appellate division of the Superior Court in New Jersey. And Lester Alford did not have that opportunity because he never had a hearing. He was never allowed, of course, to go to the law library, nor was he allowed even to communicate with some of the prisoner paralegals who help other prisoners. In fact, prisoner paralegals were told that they could not assist him during these 3 years. So we have a problem of procedural protection, and we have a problem of conditions that would shock the conscience that we think clearly violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. So this case is a case that says that people cannot violate the constitutional rights of others in our country. And Lester Alford is saying that certain prison officials did just that.
How does the prison system justify this singular treatment for Mr. Alford?
Well, we heard the defendant's lawyer give his opening statement, and basically what he tried to do is divert attention from the real problem, which is how the state, in its Department of Corrections, with awesome power, treats people. Instead, they said basically that Lester Alford had done bad things when he was in the community, although there was some misleading implications of that statement. And they said that he had broken prison rules repeatedly, primarily by getting access to cell phones. Now, it's interesting because the Department of Corrections has the responsibility to provide a prison system that will help keep the community safe, but they also have to keep people safe within the prison. That's their job. They shouldn't be letting anyone hurt the people, the prisoners who are in the custody of the state. We heard testimony about some of the most horrendous things that happen in the prisons, which are murder, rape, assaults, etc. Lester Alford was never accused of doing any of those things. He was accused of having cell phones. And basically what I think happened here is that because the Department of Corrections has been very concerned about the proliferation of cell phones in the prison, and perhaps with good reason, they decided basically that they could torture Lester Alford to get information from him about how he got the cell phones. Now, how he got these cell phones repeatedly is not a mystery. His family members didn't bring them in. People who come in, visitors and family members are searched and patted down. There's no way a visitor could bring them in. Everyone knows, including the Department of Corrections, that these cell phones are coming in because their own staff is bringing them in and making money and profiting off selling cell phones to prisoners. They wanted Mr. Alford to tell who was bringing him cell phones. Now, that's in the prison, when I talk to prisoners, they immediately understand that if Mr. Alford had given the name of the correction officer who had been bringing him cell phones, he would then be at great risk of harm from that person and from that person's colleagues and friends. So he refused to give names. And for that, they decided basically to torture him. The Department of Corrections is very clear that they have a serious cell phone problem, and they arrest officers for bringing in cell phones. They have a zero tolerance policy. There are many, many prisoners who are found guilty of possessing cell phones. There are mobsters from well-known mob families that have had cell phones. And those people are placed in the regular solitary confinement units, the punitive administrative segregation units, but not Lester Alford. They decided on a special cell for him, which had been constructed for another prisoner who had hurt a staff member a number of years ago, but enhanced for Mr. Alford. I began hearing about Lester Alford, not from him because he was unable to write to me or to other lawyers, but from other prisoners on that unit. He was in the far end. It's like, remember hearing about the back wards of psychiatric hospitals? Well, he was like in the back ward of the administrative segregation unit of East Jersey State Prison. And under such conditions that some of the staff were concerned, and certainly some of the prisoners, and prisoners began to call me and tell me that they were concerned about him because their humanity exceeded the humanity of the people who placed him there and the people who could have stopped this travesty of justice.
The state says that Mr. Alford is a dangerous gang member. He's a middle-aged man. And they're also treating with suspicion people who attend the trial.
When Lester Alford was, before he was placed in this cage, he was classified and sent to a gang unit that no longer exists at Northern State Prison. And the unit had a lot of rules, and it had three different phases, and you had to satisfy all these things to graduate from one phase to another. Then you had to renounce your gang membership. And if you did all of these things, and if the Department of Corrections decided that you were no longer a dangerous gang member, then you would graduate and go back to general population, which is what happened to Lester Alford. So Lester Alford, he is cured of his gang membership through this program before he is ever put in that cage. So for them to say that he's such a dangerous gang member that he needs to be treated in this way, that casts some aspersion on their previous determinations that he was no longer a dangerous gang member. And let me say that even if he was, there is no excuse and no defense to the fact that they placed him under isolated confinement without any kind of due process of law and under conditions that we would not keep animals in.
That was Jean Ross at the Lester Alford trial in Elizabeth, New Jersey. There's a new book out titled Nine Lives of a Black Panther, A Story of Survival. It's written by Wayne Farr, a former captain in the party's Los Angeles chapter, and is one of the few accounts published by former Panthers with a critique of what the party did wrong and what it did right. We asked Wayne Farr why he decided to write the book more than four decades after leaving the party.
I noticed that a lot of books were coming out. White radicals were writing a lot of books. And a lot of people were writing books that weren't even around at that time. And there were enough of us still around for me to get the truth out, to get the story out. And as you can see in the book, I don't bash nobody but Huey Newton, but everybody else I have nothing negative to say about. We were all young, trying to do something, and right or wrong, we went at it, you know.
Your book begins with the police raid on the Panther headquarters in L.A. That was in December 8th, 1969. Is that where you lost one of those nine lives?
Yeah, I lost a couple of them that day. It was an all-out assault. It wasn't like the police asked us to come out with our hands up or to give up or anything like that. It was a straight-out attack. And if you read the book, well, you know, I wake up, they're shooting in the building. They're busting through the front door. So my response was self-defense response that anybody would have done. I don't place myself of being a hero or anything like that, but self-defense.
And ultimately, you and most of the other Panthers involved didn't have to do any serious time behind this.
It politicized Los Angeles at that time. Although I was in jail, I was told that they had a rally where over 100,000 people showed up after the shootout, demanding our release and an end to police repression. And, you know, here in California, especially Southern California, you have a long history of animosity between blacks and the police.
And there was a history in Los Angeles, especially, of animosity between the Panther Party and the U.S. organization, Ron Karenga's group. Early in 69, that resulted in Bunchy Carter and John Huggins being killed.
Well, you know, it was a concerted effort to destroy the party. We always look at the US organization as agent provocateurs. As a matter of fact, we never knew their program or what they were about, and we didn't retaliate. See, this is the point of fact I want everybody to understand, is that we didn't retaliate. We took the high road. So all that killing is on them.
When did you become aware that there was a serious, deadly serious split in the party?
About 1970, when Huey came out and said he was the supreme commander. That's what turned me off from the whole thing. Because that spoke of ego and no humility. And I didn't expect that in a leader. You know, a leader is supposed to lead by example and also to be the most humblest person in the organization. But when you start calling yourself the supreme commander, you have a different agenda, and you turn into a cult. And that's basically what happened.
And how did that split manifest itself?
Well, it manifested itself in the destruction of the party, really, because it drove Eldridge out. Geronimo was on the run, and he had no more access to the Central Committee. So what you had was the organization. At that time, that Huey was, he called himself the supreme commander, but there was no checks, nobody to check him. All the people that could have checked him were either run out of the country at that time or dead. Bunchy, D.C., Geronimo, everybody that could have stood up to him was dead or run out of the country.
In your book, you said it was ironic that Huey Newton was taking the self-defense out of the Black Panther Party for self-defense, but was still sending hit squads to neutralize other Panthers during that intense split.
Right. That was part, again, that was part of, you know, he was taking over, and it was going to be his way or no way. And, you know, he had his goons. I wouldn't say goons, but people that fell in love with the man and not with the idea. And that's always dangerous when you hero worship to a point where you take somebody's word for granted and you don't look at their whole program.
In your book, you clearly side with the Eldridge Cleaver faction of the party. Huey Newton may have turned to drugs later on in his life, but Eldridge Cleaver became a Christian fanatic and a clothing hustler.
Well, you know, you have to do what you have to do. I don't know what he had to do to get back in the country. I don't know what Geronimo had to do to get out of prison after 27 years. Whatever they had to do, they made it out, because you had no organization. You didn't have a national organization backing you, so you were basically on your own. They had to do what they had to do, and I don't fault them for that.
And you had to do what you had to do. You were quite frank about dealing in criminal activity for private profit while you were in the party.
Well, you know, that came about because of, I feel, the system. And I've been sitting here thinking about it. The power structure would rather deal with a thug or a criminal than deal with somebody that has political aspirations. They would rather lock them up, ostracize them, or put them in jail. But then somebody that's just running the streets rampant willy-nilly, they want that to continue. Now, the way I look at the drug movement here in the United States, that it was a culmination of the free speech movement and the hippie movement that got these things flowing. And then the government used that as a way to break up the people's revolutionary struggle and put it on a whole different level. You went from Black Power one day to Superfly the next day. You know, everybody wearing naturals, and now everybody's got a Jerry curl. Now you got people running up and down the street with guns talking about their thugs. Well, what the hell is the politics of a thug? What is that all about? And who endorses that? So you've taken all the books out the penitentiary where a guy can educate himself. Here in California, they've taken the weights out the pen. They can't lift weights. So they have all that dead time to sit in the jailhouse and talk that gangster talk, which is about nothing.
So you've been thinking about this subject for a long time. So what does that mean in terms of the party's belief that the lumpen proletariat would be the grand vanguard of the revolution?
Well, you know, again, it was the destruction of the lumpen. Again, this drug culture created a culture where a kid walking down the street got $4,000 or $5,000, and you as a grown man got $500, and you telling this kid, well, go get you a job at McDonald's or a car wash and pull yourself up. Well, he's been trying to pull himself up for 400 years, so he doesn't want to hear that shit no more. And this is what happened. Now, these guys have come in every ghetto across this country has had a crack epidemic. Now, why is that?
Do you think that today a party could be established on the principles of the Black Panther Party?
It has to be. You know, it's the only way out. If you look at the Black Panther 10-point platform and program, and you can look at Elijah Muhammad's 10-point platform and program, basically they're the same.
self-determination is what we have to do. We have to, and I hate to say this, but in my old age, we have to become more right-wing and take a stance against this crime and drug that's plaguing our neighborhoods.
One of the heroes running through your book was your great friend, Geronimo Pratt, who died in 2011.
Yes. Me and Geronimo were real close. We were in jail and found out that our families were both from Louisiana, mine from Homer, Louisiana, Bayou Black, and his from Morgan City, which is on Bayou Blue. So we had a great affinity for each other, and I could relate to him on a level. Like, me and Geronimo never talked when we were together. We never had to talk. We could always signal each other and let our true intentions be known. So he was a good friend and a good mentor and a strong guy that stuck to his principles till the very end. They never broke him.
And you have not forgiven Huey Newton?
No. No, Huey, went on the gangster trip and went off on the deep end, you know, and gave up his principles for the cocaine and the women and the money, the little money he was making. But even he didn't do it on a scale that the young boys are doing it now. And he had a national organization. So that was just a progression of how the dope trade has infiltrated our community, you know, and how they're using it to really keep our people down. Nobody gets away in the dope business. This is what I tell them all the time. You're either going to get killed or you're going to go to jail. You're not going to get away with the money. Nobody gets away with the money.
When did you become aware that something like what we came to know as COINTELPRO was subverting the party?
Sometime in the 70s. Some of the people would bring articles by that had my name in it. The police would drop hints. But we knew we were under surveillance, you know, with COINTELPRO. And COINTELPRO is still working right now. It's still working right now.
Wayne Farr, author of the new book, 9 Lives of a Black Panther. Mr. Farr has since made a successful career for himself in real estate. The toll of Palestinian dead in Gaza climbs towards the 2,000 mark. The White House has endorsed the Israeli massacre of civilians at every stage of the slaughter. Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center in New York says the United States is fully complicit in Israel's crimes.
Not a minute of this war would be possible without complete and total U.S. funding, political support, diplomatic support, every step of the way. And each day, to denounce the capture of one Israeli soldier and to be silent, not only silent, but to cheer on as hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians were captured, rearrested in violation of the agreement just last year. That all happened before the bombing even began, that Israel had arrested everyone they had released in the last prisoner exchange. To be silent on the enormous number of deaths, well over 1,000 now, and to be silent in the face of this bombardment, this destruction in Gaza, Israel has declared a scorched earth on a 3-kilometer zone around this entire narrow strip. And what that means is 44% of the most concentrated, most densely populated area on earth, homes, electricity, water, everything has been pulverized, completely destroyed. This is what when they're talking about they're searching for tunnels, that's what they're doing on the entire Gaza Strip, is they have cut it in half by size and just destroyed whole life and forced the Palestinians further right to the water's edge, along with bombing of hospitals, schools. We could go on and on, children on swing sets. It's beyond comprehension. What is important here and around the world is that the world has not been silent. Every single day, There have been demonstrations of tens of thousands, whether we're talking about in New York and other major cities, or whether we're talking about around the world. And it has resonated also within the West Bank, huge demonstrations that have come out. So in every way, this is being confronted, this massacre that is going on, this unparalleled attack. It's a very important time for every form possible of unity within the movement here to stand with Gaza, with Palestine, and also on a very important time to call for ending all U.S. aid to Israel, because I say this couldn't be possible without. There are important actions coming up in the week ahead, a major demonstration, a march on the United Nations, Saturday, August 9th. So I really want to urge everyone listening, no matter how far away, to try to come in for this mass march on the UN to say the world stands with Gaza. There is also other actions coming up for those who want to be updated on all the events taking place for Gaza. There's a mobilizing meeting Tuesday, August 5th. At St. Peter's Church, that's the Jazz Church, at City Core Center, 54th and Lexington. And that will be an important place to figure out how we continue. And as I say, support for all the actions, but it's a building action also for the march on the UN. So I think the message is to stay in the streets and to use every form of petition, our voices, our anger, our collective anger and outrage.
More and more, Israel is being generally recognized as an apartheid state, but even the South African white regime did not attack its black Bantustans with this kind of ferocity.
The boycott, divest, sanction movement around the world has grown in the face of this horrendous crime. Every one of these images are broadcast around the world. Five countries of Latin America yesterday broke diplomatic relations, recalled ambassadors. Even the Geneva Human Rights Commission, a vote of 29-1, of course, only the U.S. voting for Israel, and even the imperialist robbers, pirates of Europe, they sat on their hands. They abstained on that vote. Why? Because the pressure from their own population, which overwhelmingly stands with Palestine. So it is a time when Israel, rightfully so, the Zionist state is more isolated than it's ever been in their history. And it's also accurate to say that Israel has failed in every one of its objective aims, and that the Palestinian resistance, it has won. It's quite incredible when you consider even any of these missiles, when you consider the tunnels that Israel is so determined to destroy. Picture what it takes in this day of mass surveillance, when they say every breath we take, every electronic message we send is surveilled, the drones, the constant surveillance that exists in Gaza through torture also, not only through surveillance. And yet, thousands of people were involved in building these tunnels and smuggling these weapons. So that really shows what happens when a whole population, a whole people cooperate together to build a resistance. And there are many different political and religious factions and groupings within Gaza, but they found ways to, against the Israeli Zionist regime, to cooperate intensely in massive construction projects, really, because they had no choice. There's no other option, because Israel made life unlivable in Gaza, and also as they're doing in the West Bank. It's a complete lockdown. And the bombing of, probably the worst thing was the bombing of the power plant, because that means on this flat, sandy, hot strip that the pumping of water and sanitation and sewage, they've destroyed it. So the Palestinians really know their back is to the wall and they're fighting for their very lives. But they are fighting. They certainly are.
One of the chants that you'll be using on Saturday at that demonstration at the United Nations is, Netanyahu, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide. What do you think the Israelis are trying to accomplish with this unrelenting slaughter?
They have no conceivable plan that can succeed. It is their own desperation
What they want is the silence of the grave. And that is their only plan. There's no possibility, you know, forever the Zionists demand that the Palestinians recognize the Israeli state. But in fact, Israel has never recognized the right, even for a tiny, insignificant Palestinian state. They want to destroy that very idea. They want to destroy the unity between Fatah and Hamas. That's very important. The idea of any form of even formalized unity, of calling for a unified government, is what drove Israel absolutely around the bend, because they want to keep the Palestinians not only compartmentalized in tiny little Bantustans, but politically compartmentalized. For years, they tried to use Fatah against Hamas. And finally, the Palestinians stood up, refused, and called for a unified government. All their talks had gotten them nothing. So that's another, more and more, even in the Palestinian movement, even the currents that thought through talk, through two-state, they would be able to arrive at something, have found there was nothing offered. And the only option was resistance. It is genocide, though. The Palestinian are now facing genocide in every sense, a collective punishment. And the Israeli state, even within Israel, there is a real wearing away of a great deal, and certainly here in the U.S. and around the world, the Jewish support for Israel, which was taken for granted, a fact of life. It was lone voices in terms of Jewish voices speaking out against Zionism for decades. But now this is becoming much larger, much louder, and that's an important accomplishment too.
And yet the United States House and Senate both unanimously on voice vote passed resolutions siding with Israel in this conflict, including all of the Congressional Black Caucus, not one dissent there either.
Every one of those politicians know that if they expect or hope for any political future, there's one line they're forbidden to cross. And the public example that was made of Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, where it was enormous funding from the Israeli lobby, a redistricting of her district again and again and again to try to push her out of office. And three times she overcame it and came back, but to make it impossible for her to win. Now, that was done publicly for a reason. And so when even members of Congress, you would expect differently, Barbara Lee and others, when it comes to Israel now, they are either silent or expressing support for Israel. And that shows that it is only the response from the people, that the Democratic Party to a person is now overwhelmingly, and whether it's Republican or Democrat, they are behind Israel, because in Israel is the U.S. strategic position in the region. General Haig said years ago, this is our unsinkable aircraft carrier. He didn't say this is a homeland for the Jewish people. He put it in how the U.S. looks at it. This is their aircraft carrier. This is their war machine in the region used for constant war and destabilization. And they're not going to let it sink. So that is a message that they send out again and again, but it's certainly sinking. And just as the Israelis learned in Lebanon, when they weren't able to hold a meter of land inside the border, they learned the lesson from Hezbollah in 2006. Now, in 2009 and 2012, Gaza became the attack, and both times there were ceasefires where Israel didn't gain even what they expected and hoped. And this time they've come back much, much harder, but they're going to learn the lesson again.
Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. She's also an organizer for UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, says the Israeli settler regime grows deadlier by the year. He filed this report for Prison Radio.
6 years ago, when Israel launched a blitzkrieg against Gaza, it left only after some 700 Gazans, men, women, and children, were dead. This occurred under George W. Bush, with a U.S. neocon administration winking, nodding, and blowing kisses of approval. Today, under neoliberal rule, we see that something indeed has changed under Barack Obama. It has gotten worse. For this time, Israel may double the death toll from July 2008. When one looks at the news, one must remember the old adage that in war, the first casualty is truth. For despite the PR war that projects Israel as avoiding civilians in their battle against the government of Hamas, the fact is Israel intentionally targets civilians, which is a war crime. Don't take my word for this. Zeev Schiff is Israel's preeminent military analyst, and he has stated in Haaretz newspaper, quote, "The Israeli army has always struck civilian populations," unquote. Schiff added that they do so purposely and consciously. Schiff explained that the army has never distinguished civilian from military targets, but purposely attacks civilian targets. One would know this listening to U.S. news coverage, which makes Palestinian suffering virtually invisible while privileging Israeli voices and perspectives even when absurd. Loss, too, is the real source of this carnage. Over half a century of Israeli violation of international law by massive land theft, water theft, and the imposition of a cruel military occupation by a settler colonialist state which has no use for the indigenous peoples of Palestine and yet lusts for its land. Gaza has become an open-air prison, the largest on earth, presided over by an apartheid government that kills its citizens like it's killing chickens. Obama, echoing Bush, talks about Israel's massacres by saying Israel has the right to defend itself. But one wonders, doesn't Palestine have that right as well?
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.